I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. And today we're learning about France from a French philosopher. Bernard-Henri Lévy has written 30 guidebooks. His latest guidebook is American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. Monsieur Lévy has traveled for 9 months in the United States in 2004, and now his book is just out in bookstores. And American Vertigo is a look at America from a French point of view, and it's designed so French people, Monsieur Lévy's countrymen, can learn more about our country. And it's published in English, so we can learn about our country from a French point of view. Monsieur Lévy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you. Glad to be here. Yeah. Back.
Yeah. Now, it's to me as a tour guide, it's a challenge to get my tourists primed so they can come to France and understand France rather than misunderstand France. And in your experience in traveling around America, I think there's a lot of unintentional misunderstandings that cause people to not connect from an awareness point of view.
Of course. I would even say more than misunderstanding. I believe that between two peoples, Americans and French, for example, you have a wall. A wall of what? An immaterial wall. An abstract wall, a wall of clichés, a wall of préjugés, a wall of commonplaces, a wall of preconceived ideas. It is like a wall.
And it's a big problem.
Yes, it seems to be like a wind, like a smoke, or like a fog. But it is smoke and fog. It is smog. You have a smog of prejudice, a smog of cliché, which is thin, which is very thin, which is consistent, which prevents us to have a fresh eye on each other's.
Now, if we're coming to your country, a lot of times there's just simple misunderstandings. In America, fast service is good service. When I go to France, fast service is rude service, I think, in a restaurant. Is that true?
It is true. I am a bad judge, a bad witness, because I like fast service. In this way, I'm more American than French. I hate the fact of staying 2 hours, 3 hours at the table, waiting for the dishes and so on. So much lost time. I am American, but you are right.
But the French waiter, he's respecting you to let you sit for
a long
time.
In America, too. It is fast service, but with respect. No,
with respect.
We cannot say that. And sometimes in France, you have slow service with disrespect.
Okay, so there's a respect undergirding that's essential. There's subtleties that a lot of Americans miss. When you step into a shop in France, I think it's flat out rude not to say bonjour, monsieur. And when you leave, au revoir, or is that changing now?
They say bonjour and they say au revoir.
Yeah, that's different, I think. And here it's not.
They do.
So these are innocent mistakes that people made just from not understanding the cultural differences. To me, there's an interesting thing about how a society works together. There's this social contract idea. Rousseau is famous for people working together. You're a philosopher, I'm not, and maybe you can help me here. But my understanding of the social contract is everybody gives up a little bit of freedom so they can all live together happily.
Absolutely. It's exactly that. You are not a philosopher, but you got the point, my
dear.
I got the
point.
Exactly.
Now, is that Rousseau? That's classic Rousseau.
It is Rousseau, classic Rousseau, social contract. Exactly.
Now, how does Locke and Rousseau different in their approach to the social contract?
It's different. Locke doesn't speak so much about the social contract. He spoke about habeas corpus. He spoke about individual rights.
And the rugged individualism.
Individual right.
Because my hunch is American culture is inclined to embrace Locke, whereas European culture, which is easier with socialism, embraces Rousseau.
Exactly. You are the country of the individual's individual freedom, the sovereignty of the individual. You are the country who resists, for example, too much presence or too much role of the state. Because of that, you have a distrust toward the state.
And you're the guys who
maybe
pay.
Maybe too much distrust. You have, and we have something to tell you about that. Maybe on the reverse, we have too much confidence in the state, and maybe you have something to teach us. We should sit around the table, you American, us French, with our experience of the relationship between individual and state. There is half to take in your experience, half to take in ours, and the two together, we could have a good pattern.
Because you guys pay such high taxes, and you're willing to do this, whereas we are anti-tax.
We are anti-tax too. We want, as we say in France, le beurre et l'argent du beurre, the butter and the money of the butter, which means that we would like to have the healthcare system, the welfare state, and so on without paying the price.
You want the cake and eat it too.
The cake and eat it too, exactly.
But
the American version of le beurre et l'argent du beurre, the
butter,
cake and eat it too. We want the cake and eat it
And you want the butter
too.
And you want the money it takes to buy the butter.
Exactly.
Voilà. Now, I think that in America, we've got two options. big bad government or little good government.
You have a middle. You have a middle way. You have a middle way. And you had, at the beginning of America, in the time of the founding fathers, you had this debate, and people like George Washington, they designed a way which is exactly in the middle of the two,
okay,
and which is a good way.
But the French have a different option, which is big good government, I think.
Yeah.
That's an option. In France, if you pay high taxes, you would expect big,
good government. Good government, absolutely. It does not mean that we reach it. It does not mean that we have a good government. Sometimes we have just an obese government.
Obese,
yes. Our French obesity, which is obesity of the government. But the goal is what you say.
But your government is quite active. You tried to have a 35-hour work week recently. What happened to that? We failed on that.
We have it. We have 35 hours. Which I think is a mistake. We should have a law which could allow people who want to do more to do more.
There's a limit, actually, for 35.
Of course. Really? You are obliged.
So the government decided...
Decided to cut at 35. And if you want to work more, if you want to earn more money, you are not authorized. You are not allowed. This is a mistake.
That's a problem.
This is the limit of the overstressing of the role of the state.
It's a good example.
Good to give the possibility to people who wants to be quiet. Good to give the possibility to remain at 35. But if I want to work more, I should be allowed.
You also have very long vacations, I think, dictated by the government.
Dictated by the government, obliged, law.
What's the standard vacation?
If I am in a company and I want to take 2 weeks of vacation only, I will be sued by the company, by the syndicate, by the union.
Forced relaxation. You must relax.
Exactly.
And I think France actually invented the concept of vacation. I mean, Club Med is a French company.
Club Med is a French, yes. And you had the gender of Karl Marx. Karl Marx had a gender called Paul Lafargue, the husband of his daughter. You know, the Karl Marx had a daughter. She married a Frenchman called Paul Lafargue, a great socialist leader in France of the 19th century. And he wrote a book called Le droit à la paresse, The Right to Laziness. The Right to Laziness, accusing all his fellow socialist friends to be too much involved in work, to be too much involved in the story of having a different system of work and so on. Paul Lafargue said, please, let's stop with work. Let's ask the right to laziness. This is the only true revolutionary right. This is a very French topic.
And that's very subversive where I come from.
And it is subversive.
I'm talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. He's a French philosopher. He's finished traveling around the United States for nearly a year. He's written a book called American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. His name is a household word in France. He's written 30 books, and he is sharing his take on France for us Americans planning to go to France, and we'll get a better understanding of the two cultures. You know, we're talking about the French having a short work week, a by law required long vacation, and there's also this little beautiful private time between work and when you go home.
In France?
Yeah.
Yes.
That doesn't exist here. We have to go straight home. Tell me about this special magic private time.
This is a good side, yes, of a French way of living, a sort of magic hour between the two, yes, and in an intermediary area. And also, I would say that we cut really between the work and the private life. There is a real break. In America, I see so many people who don't forget their work and their comrades of work and so on when they are on leisure and when they are on private life. In France, we forget. You can have a best friend on your work. When you go home, you cut completely. You close the shutters. You are in another space, in another temporality, is in another life. There is this idea of two separate lives, the life of privacy and the life of work. America, you are a Protestant country, and the border between privacy and the rest is, and the public life and the professional life is less well defined than in France.
So there's something sacred. I have a French friend, and when we were going to be working during lunch, this was an example of breaking that sacred time.
Absolutely. Sacred and secret. Sacred and secret, yeah.
Sacred and secret. In Europe, right now, you're struggling with quite an interesting evolution as you decide how united you want to be. The European Union. Is this just a way for France and Germany not to have another war?
I would say that the European Union, yes, might be considered at that.
Bottom line.
But I don't believe that we will build another big, huge, supplemental nation.
Not a United States of Europe.
United States, no. But we are building an engine, we are building a motor, we are building a machine which has two functions, two tasks, two roles. Number one, prevent war, create peace. Number two, weaken tyrannies, dictatorship, and promote democracy. Look at Portugal, look at Spain, look at Greece. They were authoritarian states with crypto-fascist regimes. Europe had the precise task to dissolve, to ruin these fascism. So Europe is a machine which main function is to bring to the peoples peace and democracy.
Quite
this
effective.
Is the role of Europe.
Quite effective. Portugal has no choice but to
exactly.
be modern democracy.
Exactly.
Wow.
I am European for that. I'm not European because I feel that we have to forget our Frenchiness. I'm not European because I believe that we have to suppress the borders between nations. No, I am European because I believe that it is the only way to bring in the world and in our world, and for example, tomorrow in Turkey, peace and democracy. You know, for example, I am often asked.
So that's a rationale for bringing Turkey into the EU. It just
exactly.
enforces democracy on that
exactly.
country.
I am often asked, are you in favor of Turkey coming in Europe?
Yeah.
My answer is, I'm not going to make a big abstract. If Europe can help Turkey to be 100% faithful to human rights, to recognize her crime in the Armenian genocide, to embrace the European conception of democracy and so on, then I'm in favor.
And
if Europe can serve to this, if Europe can have this utility, right. Vive l'Europe.
That's very big. And are those preconditions for Turkey to join?
No, they are not.
So that's how
I
you
hope
would
they
support
will be.
It. Yeah.
I hope they will be.
But then, right now you're dealing with this Polish plumber problem, when that I think that's a French advertising slogan or something, where you've got all of these Eastern Europeans who are new members of the European Union. They're flooding the West and working cheaper than Western workers, and that's a problem. If Turkey joins, wouldn't you have even a worse Polish plumber problem?
My dear, I met the life mate that this last year I had many times to call a plumber. Many times, 3 or 4 times, maybe 5 times, my wife and me. We never met a Polish one. This is a myth. This is a xenophobic myth. The plumbers, they are still French. Those poor Polish, what is the hell with that? They are just joining Europe, joining democracy. It was absolutely disgusting
but
to
I don't
accuse
mean,
them. No, no,
yeah.
no.
I don't mean literal, but I mean you have a problem of workers coming in and underbidding French labor, don't you?
No, of course not. The salaries remain high. The unions remain powerful. It's not the point.
Okay.
And I would add that we owe that. We owe it to the Eastern Europe workers. We abandoned them during so many years. We left them to their bad fate. At the end, after 40 years of slavery, we accept them in Europe. Even if it costs us a little, we have to pay the price. As the German did,
by the
way.
I was going to say, the West Germans paid the price to bring Eastern Germany up to speed.
And it is great to do that.
And
it was a grand debt.
You have a grand European vision of that.
It was a debt. The Western Germans had this debt toward the Eastern German.
And you think Europe in general has a debt towards Eastern Europeans?
Of course.
The same way. Is this idea unusual, or are you mainstream with this thinking?
I'm not mainstream.
I think you're enlightened, but are you mainstream?
I'm not mainstream, but I don't believe that I'm an exception. I think that we are numerous to believe that the way we acted toward Eastern Europe was a pure scandal.
Right.
The fact of resigning, of accepting that half of Europe would belong to another civilization, will remain for centuries, for the next ages, under the boot of a dictatorship, was purely disgusting. So we have to repair. And frankly, it does not cost us a lot.
No.
It does not cost us a lot. I repeat, I did not meet one single Polish plumber in the last years.
Very good. Is another reason for Europe to be uniting is just to compete with the United States in creating a big free trade zone?
We have it already. The free trade zone We don't need the next construction of Europe to have it. We have it. We have the euro.
That's true.
We have the free trade zone. We can remain like that.
And your economy in Europe is bigger than America's economy.
The economy is good. The euro is strong.
I mean, you have a bigger GDP than the United
Absolutely.
States.
Absolutely. We could stop moving if the target was only to compete with America. We made it.
Okay.
If we have to keep moving, it is for the reasons I told you before. Not competition with America, but improving the democratic state of the world.
Why did the Constitution fail? It was recently voted down. Is this just a temporary setback?
I hope so. It failed because we had, as I say, American vertigo. It was our European vertigo. We had a sudden vertigo in front of the task, of the stake, of the proceeding way of all that, the idea of abandoning part of our identity. We were afraid. There was a sort of ultimate frightness in front of the void, in front of the emptiness.
Too big of a step, too fast.
Yeah, maybe.
Spinning around and getting...
I was in favor of the Constitution, against the no, but I can understand it.
But since 1947, I think Eurovisionaries have been trying to convince Europeans to trade away sovereignty for real power for Europe, right?
It's a trick, and they achieved partly, and there was a stop. I hope that it will be a provisional stop.
My observation, Monsieur Levy, is that as Europe unites, the regions are more free to wave their flags. When I first started traveling in France, I believe if somebody in Brittany had a child and named them a Celtic name, they would lose their French citizenship. Today, that would be laughable.
Absolutely. You are totally right. Good observation. You have two levels of identity. You have the European level, the regional level, and the national level. If the intermediary level weakens, it will be for the benefit of the two others.
So historically, in our generation, the national level is withering away, and we have Catalonian people in Barcelona not threatening Madrid, and Britain people not threatening Paris.
And you will have Catalonia coming closer and feeling closer links with French Pays Basque, you will have some new brotherhoods, some new fraternities across the present borders between peoples who are very
struggling,
much alike.
You see that in Northern Ireland. You see Catalonian and Basque tourists in Ulster.
Exactly.
It's very strange. You don't see Basque and Catalonian people in big numbers elsewhere, but there's an affinity for people who are struggling against...
I did not know that, but I'm glad to learn.
In Catholic communities in Northern Ireland, they fly the Palestinian flag, uh-huh. and in Protestant communities, they fly the Israeli flag.
Uh-huh.
It's very interesting. I'm talking with Bernard-Henri Levy. He is the author of American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. This is a book that Monsieur Levy, who's a philosopher from France, has written after a 9-month tour around the United States, taking an analytical look at the differences between our two cultures. We have a lot of angst in Europe and in the world with Islam. And I'd like to just talk briefly about the Islamic challenges that Europe has. Europe is a geriatric continent with the people who live there. And many people say if Europe doesn't get progressive about taking in other cultures, other religions, Europe will just be in an old folks' home and pretty soon be not much of a factor anymore. Is that your take on this? And is that a reason to work with Islam?
It is absolutely true. If we had not this population of immigrants, we would be dead. We would be out of blood and out of breath.
Wow.
You know, this is a reality. We don't make enough children. The renewal of the generation is not done, so we need this immigration.
Is that just now, because educated, affluent Europeans don't multiply very, very much? They just choose to have less children?
There is a strange climate atmosphere of depression, of nervous breakdown going on in Europe since a few years, which maybe is not very favorable to the fact of making children. I don't know, without being too rude. But now... the fact that we have to have some immigrants, it is not the end of the story. The end is, number one, to integrate them properly, which we don't do enough. And number two, when we make the effort to integrate them, not to tolerate the growth of Islamism, for example, on our soil, not to tolerate a sort of rude and violent attitude against the way of being French and so on, then the political problem begins. That's what I mean. have some immigrants, it's one thing, but we have to deal politically with that. And to deal politically with that, it means, for example, to defend and to support the moderate Muslims, the democratic Muslims, those Muslims who want Islamism being a question of faith and of intimacy against the fundamentalist, the theocratic, the real clash of civilization of today.
Okay, so support the moderate Muslims who will send their girls to school without the head scarf.
Without, of course.
So you would support the French
law,
strong law, yeah, against religious
headgear. Absolutely, absolutely. Number one, because the veil is not a religious sign in France, it is a political one.
Yeah.
Number two, because this political sign means not liberty, but slavery. It is a slavery, it is a veil imposed by the fathers and the brothers to the young girls. It is not a free act, it is not a free choice. And number three, because the school in the Republican tradition in France is a space of learning freedom, of learning that the roots which you have is not the last word of your identity, it is the first one. The first one is your roots. The last one is something else, which you have to be taught at school. And to be taught that, it means to take the veil off. Exactly like for the little Breton, the little children from Bretagne 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to come to school with sabots. How do you call sabots? These wooden shoes.
Right.
You know, sabots.
The Celtic shoes, the wooden shoes. Yes.
Wooden shoes, yes. No, the school said, no, you have to put real shoes.
So that's forced assimilation. They wanted people to assimilate.
A part of it. Then you have to keep your memory. You have to keep your pride. You have to keep your roots. You have to keep all that. But also to assimilate to the community, exactly as you do in America.
Yeah.
In America, you can be an African-American, a Native American, an Arab, a Jew, and you are an American patriot.
So this
you achieve the chemistry, which we don't always achieve so well.
So the challenge for the French government is to find a way to have the Muslim community willingly assimilate.
Exactly, which is often the case, but not always.
Is that a realistic hope?
I think so. I think that if we really try to deal with that, if we really try to recognize also our own mistakes, because you cannot ask to these guys to recognize their mistakes if you don't do for yours. We are guilty of some racism toward our Muslims. So number one, you have to recognize this. We have to find the remedies against this racism, and then we have to ask them to be faithful.
I'm speaking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. He's a philosopher and a journalist. He's written 30 books in France, and he's written a book that is of great interest to Americans, and it's available in French and English, American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. Monsieur Lévy traveled around our country for 9 months in the year 2004. American Vertigo is in the bookstores. I want to just finish our interview by letting you be our French tour guide for a few minutes, if you don't mind. I'll just ask you some questions about things that I find confusing as an American visiting your country. And as an American, I want to find La France profonde, you say. Profound France. What does that mean, and where is it?
I don't like this sentence. It has a very bad political act of birth. You know, it is the French extreme right who opposes La France réelle et La France officielle.
Huh.
The real France, the deep France, and the official and the abstract France. So I don't like it.
That
so
has
much.
Political overtones. I didn't know
yes,
that.
Yes, it has. But France profonde is just
what
France.
What if I say you would rather not a tourist have a quintessential France in mind?
This is okay. La quintessence
okay.
de la France.
Okay.
Quintessence
oh, France. That's yeah. good. I'll change my vocabulary yeah. then. Okay. Le quintessential?
Yeah.
Is that
la quintessence French? De la France.
La quintessence de la France.
France. Yes.
Où est? Where is that?
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Everywhere where you have people who are... who have a real knowledge of their own culture.
A terroir. The terroir is an interesting concept in
but
wine
also,
and with people,
also
with culture.
In the cities, also in the cities. You have quintessence de la France also in Paris, also in Bordeaux. Urbanity belongs to this quintessence. This would be a cliché. To believe that the quintessence is only in the terroir would be a cliché.
Okay, good
quintessence
point.
Quintessence is also in Toulouse, also in Paris. I see in your book, you speak about Notre-Dame, about Le Marais, and so on. This is quintessence.
Beautiful. When I'm traveling in France, I love a cheese plate. We don't get that on menus here. Is the cheese plate in the French restaurant, is that becoming less popular? Is that vanishing?
In France?
Yeah.
No, it is still there.
It's still there.
In the good restaurant, you have a big cheese plate with so many different cheeses. Which come from every part of the country. We used to say that every area of France produces her own cheese, and that this is a sort of pride. Why not?
A complete meal still comes with that for a lot of people. Yeah. That's good. I've noticed there's fewer topless bathers on the beaches in France. Is that because of a conservative prudishness or a more of a recognition of the danger of skin cancer?
I did not notice it. I don't know.
You haven't noticed it?
No.
Okay.
You see, it's like me for American Vertigo. You know France better than I am, than I do. When you have a fresh, candid, foreign eye, you have better information than the intimate, day-to-day, day-after-day observation.
There's a lot to that. That's interesting. Americans are charmed by the movies Amélie and Chocolat. We just love those. It's our quintessential France, really. Are there any movies that charm French people about American culture in a similar way?
Westerns. Yes, of course. They belong to the very identity. You cannot understand the American space, sense of space, immensity of space without the Westerns.
I took 1,000 people to France this last year on my different tours that I lead. And I'm concerned because they spend their hard-earned money on their vacation. I want to know how they're received by the local people, regardless of the differences between our countries politically. I asked them after their trip, were you received warmly? Was there any problem? Nobody reported any coldness or rudeness from the French people.
Of course.
I was taking a tour of a little family winery in southern France. And you know how these wonderful mom-and-pop wineries take visitors around? There was 10 people on the tour, maybe 4 Americans and 6 people from around Europe. The language of the tour was English. And she said, before we start, we've got some Americans here. I want to just say publicly that we still are thankful for America for freeing us from the tyranny of Nazism and Hitler and so on. A lot of Americans are upset because they think if France disagrees with us, we're not thankful for D-Day. I mean, that's absurd, I think.
My dear, as for myself, I belong to a family. My father was a freedom fighter against the Nazis during the war, and before that, a freedom fighter in the International Brigade in Spain during the Civil War. Since I was in the age of understanding it, he taught me that if I was alive, if I had been born, it was because and thanks to America.
Wow.
My father was a Jew. If America had not liberated France, even freedom fighter as he was, he would have been finished to be caught, to be captured, and to be killed. I would not be born. I was born in 1948 after the war because of the American army. So since my childhood, I paid homage and I was grateful to the American army. For me, the GI. I know that today you have some people who identify GI with the worst of the world and so on. You know, GI in Iraq. For me, the image of the GI is forever, till the day of my death, identified to the liberty and to the resistance to tyranny. It will be like this all my life. On the reverse, I can tell you that I met so many people in America who know, who remember, even if it is further, they remember of the time where they were slave people belonging to an empire. There was a colony. America was a colony in the hands of an empire, which was the English Empire. And they remember, they know, because they learned at school that their ally at this time, the ally who helped them to decolonize themselves, was whom? The French.
Yes, you were the first to recognize, I think,
of course,
as a country.
The French recognized, the first to be at your side. American people know that. They learned that at school. Even the most simple people know that. They know that we have some links together, which is absolutely impossible to break.
You were born in 1948. I know many Europeans named Johnny or Frankie, as old as you, the same age.
Exactly.
And
they
were named after GIs.
After GIs.
Do you know this in France also?
Oh, of course I know. I remember my mother who passed by, but my mother who was a charming lady, young until the end. When she told me about the GIs in 45, 46, before my birth, she told me with so much emotion and so much gratitude, they were really the embodiment, the very face of the liberty. For our generations, my father's and myself, America is the very face of liberty, of resistance to tyranny. That is why I am so angry when I hear some more young people in France doing some stupid identification and saying that because of the maybe mistake of a current administration who said that America is an imperialist country or even a fascist country, this is disgusting. You cannot say that. It is an insult.
That's why you call yourself anti-American.
Of course. Okay. And that is why I wrote my book.
Right.
American Vertigo is a book written in reaction to this disgusting way of thinking.
We call our flag the red, white, and blue. Does that bother you? Because you have the same colors on your flag.
It's okay. I'm ready to share that with America. We share so much. Let's share that too.
Merci, monsieur. What is the state of tax evasion in France? Is it still a national pastime? Europeans are very clever about not paying their taxes.
Unfortunately, yes. We are very good at that and unfortunately proud of it, which is disgusting because it is a lack of duty. It is a lack of citizenship. The poorest pay the price, not the richest. And it is disgusting, but it is a national sport very often. Not always. Don't be careful about the caricature, but sometimes.
Okay. In America, I feel the attention span is getting shorter. I'm thankful we're on public radio here because we assume our listeners have a longer attention span. You're a journalist. Do you find that same problem in France where everything has to be fast and sound bites?
Exactly the same. And maybe sometime more. Look at your show, radio show, we have time. Look at Charlie Rose on the TV. We have not a French Charlie Rose.
You don't have a French Charlie Rose?
Of course not. We have not a serious program where you can have half an hour of quiet speech, gathering great attention. On my book tour in America, so many people, one out of two or three who come from to give me my book to sign, they tell me, I saw you in Charlie Rose. We don't have that any longer in France. We had Bernard Pivot, who is no longer on air.
So this American fast-paced life, fast food culture, it's creeping into France.
Exactly. On this ground, surely, I'm definite.
Are the children, the teenagers, hanging out at McDonald's in France, and it's not considered an American restaurant? It's just the popular place for teenagers to be?
Absolutely. They love it. I remember my children, they are now grown up, but they love McDonald's.
I think that's an irony because Americans would never go to McDonald's in France if they want to be, you know, like temporary local. But the irony is that's where the local people hang out.
It is one of our ironies in our relationship. There are many ironies, which is the fun of it.
You never learned to drive.
No.
Is that common in France?
No.
So why did you never learn to drive?
I don't know, because I had no time, because I was always driven by friends and to be frank, girlfriends. I don't know. This is my way of my French libertinage, maybe.
A trace of
my French libertinage.
As an American tourist in France, I'm always looking for a good red wine. Is there a good rosé wine?
I don't drink wine.
You don't drink
wine? At all. I don't like wine. I don't drink wine. I am so un-French.
You're un-French,
yes. You know, James Joyce said that he did not speak English, but that he spoke Unglish. U-N-G-L-I-S-H. Unglish.
Unglish.
So same. I feel sometimes un-French.
Interesting. You were in the United States for 9 months traveling around. Did you find any food that you really were pleasantly surprised by? What was your favorite cuisine experience?
French food.
In America?
You have the best French food in the world.
Tell me more.
I tell you, the best French restaurant in the world are often in America. You have great French restaurants in Los Angeles, in Houston, Texas, in New York City. French and Italian, you have three. French, Italian, Japanese restaurant, which are great. America is a cosmopolitan country. America is a rendezvous of cultures. So it's normal that you have the best French food in the world.
Is France experiencing a spiritual vacuum? Is there no... the churches are quite empty in France.
Quite empty. This is one of the differences between us. Your churches are full. Ours are empty. It's very difficult to find a real atheist in America. In France, it is very difficult to find a true, genuine Catholic or Protestant.
There was a Hindu woman going around France earlier this year. I think her name was Amma. And thousands of people were coming out to hug her. You know, there's different things happen, little cults and so on. Do you see a hunger for spirituality in France?
Maybe we have a nostalgia of it. Yes, I think so. We have a nostalgia, therefore a hunger, but it is only a hunger today because the churches, the temples, the synagogue a little less. You have among the Jews, you have a real achievement of this hunger You have a real feeling of belonging and so on. But for the Christian, no. Churches are empty.
I've been talking with Bernard-Henri Lévy. Monsieur Lévy has just written a book called American Vertigo, A Journey in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. It's a report about his 9-month trip around the United States in 2004, giving a fascinating insight into our culture and a fascinating insight into your culture. Monsieur Lévy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, my dear. Thank you, Rick. Thank you very much. My journey was 2004 and 2005, by the way. I finished it at the middle of 2005. The last stage of it, which was in Guantanamo, was in, May or June 2005. So it was nearly a year.
It sounds like it was a fascinating experience for you, and I'm sure
it was a great moment of my life, great experience, great enjoyment, and I learned so much about you, America, and about me. Because the great thing with travel, when you travel, and you know that, Rick, is that you take news from the others, of course, but you take also news of yourself.
Yes.
It is a way to get informations about yourself.
Amen.
And I did.
When I travel, when I leave my country, I feel in so many cases I learn more about my own country and my own position on this planet.
That is why this American Vertigo was such an enriching experience for me.
American Vertigo, Bernard-Henri Lévy. Merci bien, monsieur.
Merci, monsieur. Thank you.